This material is subject to copyright. No unauthorized recording, editing, copying, or distribution is permitted without the consent of the Economic Research Council. All rights reserved. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org. Audio lectures by the Economic Research Council.
I'd like to welcome Nick O'Donohoe. Special Impact Investment, A Revolution in Financial Markets. That's a hell of a title anyway, for starters. Hugely qualified. 15 years in J.P. Morgan and 14 years in Goldman Sachs. And with his own fan club he came this evening. Second row on the right-hand side. And they said they even paid to attend. I mean, that's love. The project of that Nick has taken on, I think, is hugely ambitious. A government-funded, another government-funded institution for trying to help sort of quasi-commercial social enterprise businesses, sort of quasi-charities. Huge problem because almost impossible to raise funds in this area. Banks are not functioning in that area at all. And I think really we want to hear what he has to say about it, because it's going to be very exciting.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and it's a great pleasure to be here. It's a real privilege to be asked to speak at the Economic Research Council, and it is a great pleasure to see. It's really very flattering when, you know, people who used to work for you show up and pay money to actually come and hear you speak. You would have thought that after many years of listening to me, they would have had enough by now. But welcome, all of you. So I'd like to do really three things tonight. First of all, I'd like to give people in the room a better understanding of what social impact investing means, and when we use the term, what exactly are we talking about. Secondly, and somewhat selfishly, I'd like you all to have a better understanding what Big Society Capital does, because we think it's an important government initiative, and it's important that it be understood, and particularly among a commercial, sophisticated commercial and financial audiences such as this one. And also I'd like to put the area of social investment in somewhat of a broader context, in the context of what today's sort of political and social realities are, and explain why I think a move towards more responsible investment is both significant and important. So let me start with a definition. What exactly do we mean when we talk about social impact investing? And you'll hear the terms both social investing and impact investing. They mean broadly the same thing. The expression social investing really developed here, or it's in its modern form, it developed here in the UK about 10 years ago, when the previous government set up what was called the Social Investment Task Force. The Americans sort of picked up on the idea, but they found the word social somewhat distasteful. So they renamed it to impact investing. So when we talk about social and impact investing, we're really talking about the same thing. And really what it means is making investments with the intent of creating a positive social impact over and above some sort of financial return. So in terms of what that can mean, I mean, the investments we're talking about today can be as diverse as investing in companies that create affordable housing or build affordable housing in India, or it can be in companies that provide clean water or education or healthcare in Africa. Obviously, both of those examples in the developing world. Or in the developed world, it can be investing in making funding available to charities so that they can help to grow the services they provide, and also providing money to investors to complement government funding in areas like drug rehabilitation or long-term youth unemployment or the likelihood of ex-offenders reoffending. So it's a very broad range of different social issues that social investors have chosen to address. But what all these investments have in common is really that the person who's making them has an objective over and above just maximizing his risk-adjusted return. So that's a very sort of broad, high-level definition, investments with the intent of creating a social impact. It raises a number of questions, and some of which I'll try to address. The first one, and that I think I get asked more than any other, is whether or not, if you make this type of investment, is it really necessary to have to have to sacrifice return, financial return, in order to achieve this social impact? And a recent report by JP Morgan and the Global Impact Investing Network asked that question to about 3,000 or so investors or impact investors in the United States, whether or not they thought there was a financial trade-off in terms of in order to generate this financial return, this positive social impact. 65% of those people making those investments said no. They don't believe that there's a trade-off, and they believe that it's perfectly consistent with maximizing financial return to make these type of investments. They point mostly to microfinance. Microfinance is something that started in Bangladesh about 25 years ago. Today, £60 billion of capital has found its way to microfinance institutions around the world, and there's 100 million people who have access to financial services that didn't have access before. And in many cases, those investments have, in fact, provided a competitive, risk-adjusted financial return. I have to say, I mean, my job today is working here in the UK with Big Society Capital. I have to say that it may be true in the developing market that if you can bring new and innovative ways of doing business, and that's what microfinance was. It was somebody going to a poor area in Bangladesh saying, look, I'm going to do something other banks, traditional banks, don't do. I'm going to lend money principally to women, to groups of women, and I think I can charge a rate of interest that will allow me to build a sustainable business. But I think if you move to the developed markets, I think it's the sort of things that I'll talk about Big Society Capital is doing. I think it is highly unlikely that you will make commercial returns. And I think almost inevitably, when we talk about social impact investing, we're talking about making investments that actually create where you have to be prepared, or somebody has to be prepared to effectively pay for the impact or trade off their financial return. So that's the second question I get is how all this fits with socially responsible investing. And is it the same thing? Because I think most of us have heard about SRI type investing. And indeed, over the last 10 years, it's become a very visible and successful form of investing, I think, for many fund managers here and abroad. And I think the answer is it's not the same. SRI investing typically starts with a basic negative screen. So you screen out tobacco, you screen out defense companies, and so on. In its more activist form, socially responsible investing actually takes a more activist approach with the companies they invest in. So they actively lobby their investee companies and so on to make sure that they're running their businesses consistently with their set of whatever environmental standards. And their belief is that if companies do good, they'll do well. And certainly there's a case, an increasing case actually, an increasing evidence that investing in companies that have responsible environmental, social, and governance policies actually do outperform over the long term companies that don't. But that's not, SRI investing is not social impact investing. It's not what I'm talking about tonight. And the difference really is that as a socially responsible investor starts with a company and starts with a business and tries to build a responsible, acceptable environmental, social, governance structure around that. A social impact investor starts at the other end. He starts with a social issue, and he tries to wrap a viable financial model around this social issue. So if I give you some real life examples, the Gates Foundation is an organization that worries about the lack of distribution of effective drugs and the cost of distribution of effective drugs in Africa, particularly to children in Africa. Their solution is to work with JP Morgan in a transaction that was actually launched here in London about a week ago, which is a bond offering where the money they're seeking to raise, $100 million, the $100 million will be used to address, to find products that exist in U.S. biotech companies that have applicability in Africa but would not otherwise find their way there because of the cost of development and distribution, and to fund those products. For the investors, the people who are putting up the $100 million, they have a maximum return of 2%. and they have a guarantee, first loss guarantee by the Gates Foundation and the Swedish Development Agency of 20%. So you've got the first 20% of loss guaranteed, your upside is 2%. That is a significant trade-off from what it would normally, most commercial investors would do. And as I said, JP Morgan are seeking to raise $100 million for that transaction. There are other investors, high net worth individuals, Ronald Cohen, for example, who's a chairman of our company, Big Society Capital, about 10 years ago, identified the fact that in the UK, there was very little capital or investment available for deprived areas, for any businesses. So he started a company called, a venture capital and private equity company called Bridges. And Bridges raised money to address, to make normal traditional private equity investments with one important constraint. And that constraint was that they would only invest in areas that were deemed to be in the lowest 25% of what they called the deprivation index. So it was a way of putting capital into deprived areas in the UK, creating businesses and creating jobs. In actual fact, over the last the first Bridges fund has been running now for 8 or 9 years, and actually has achieved returns that are very close to competitive returns by the standards of any venture capital organization. So something like 15% or 16%. There are other investors who identified or worried about the fact that 70% of prisoners, short-term prisoners who come out of prisons in the UK, reoffend within 18 months, and the reason that these prisoners reoffend has a lot to do with the fact that nobody tries to help them when they're in prison, nobody tries to help them when they get to the prison gate, nobody tries to help them when they get out in the community. So they designed what was called a social impact bond, and the way a social impact bond works is they raised about £7 or 8 million, which they used to intervene with these prisoners in one specific jail in Peterborough. And if the interventions were successful, the prisoners would reoffend less, the government would save money, and the government would then share those savings with the investors. So that's an example of a very social impact bond, which has actually attracted a lot of attention in the media and in financial markets broadly. And it's an example of a structure that can be used to fund interventions that wouldn't otherwise take place, and if they're successful, to achieve a payment and some sort of return, repayment of capital and a return for the investors. So, what all these people have in common is they try to think about how to address social problems through the creative use of private capital rather than just the traditional route, which is to give a grant or a philanthropic grant give out aid. Sometimes they recognize that they're giving up return. As I said in the Gates example, every private banking client of JP Morgan who invests in that transaction knows they're not getting a risk-adjusted return. In others, like Bridges, actually it turned out that they did get something that was at least a second quartile venture capital return in the UK, so something very close to commercial. And in other transactions, the social impact bond for Peterborough Jail, I think really realistically they don't know what the return is likely to be. The payoff, if the intervention is successful, is anywhere between a return for the investors of 7.5% to 12.5%. What the probability of achieving that success rate is, we don't know. But again, the reason that investors make the decision to do this is principally driven by the fact that they believe there's a social issue that they want to help address. They could do it through just a philanthropic donation, but they choose to do it because they believe more effectively through a social investment. How big is the market for this type of investing and who's doing it? I mean, the answer is the market's really small. It's tiny if you compare it to the traditional commercial markets. There's $80 trillion or so of capital in global markets. But it is growing, and I think it's growing relatively quickly, and it's driven by a number of factors. The first thing that's driving the growth of social impact investing is just, to be honest, a general disillusionment with traditional finance and investment and financial institutions, and that's relatively easy to understand if you look at what's happened in financial markets over the last 5 years. And that general disillusionment is finding its voice in a whole lot of different ways. I mean, it's finding its voice by people in tents outside of St. Paul's, but it's also finding its voice in high net worth individual clients of our largest private banks largest private banks in the world who are saying, actually, we'd like you to consider doing something slightly different with at least part of our money. And we'd like you to think about focusing at least part of our money on sort of a non-traditional, more socially oriented investment. Another thing that's driving the growth of social investment is the fact that our governments are running out of money. And for a long time, we believed that the role of the private sector was to grow at all costs, and the role of government was to sort of pick up the pieces, to provide a social safety net, to protect the vulnerable in our communities, to ensure civil society functions by providing healthcare and education and pensions to everybody. And what we're seeing now is that governments, although that or some of that may be a laudable objective, governments cannot afford to do all of that. Philanthropy, which has been a critical complement to government spending, is also limited. And in a world also where government budgets are shrinking, I think governments, particularly in this country, are becoming much more conscious of the need to spend their money in a more disciplined and rigorous and results-focused way. And in the UK specifically, this is being manifested by a move towards much more of a payments-by-results model. So instead of just simply giving out a grant to an organisation to provide a social intervention, government is saying, and the best and biggest example of this, which some of you will be familiar with, is the Work Programme, where we used to pay £800 million to various, a whole host of different organisations, supposedly to help get unemployed people back to work. Now what this government has said is, we'll still pay up to £800 million, but we'll only do it, we'll do it on a results basis. So these hundreds of organisations around the country that are involved in this programme only get paid if the people to whom that get assigned to them actually get back to work. And what this payments by results model does, because it transfers effectively the risk of success in the intervention from government to whoever is funding the intervention, what it creates the potential for public-private partnerships, and it creates the potential for investments. And the social impact bond, for example, is an example of where social investment has been used to fund an intervention against what is effectively a payments by results model. So that whole area, so that government changing government spending and philosophy is driving social investment opportunities. And a third factor that's driving social investment opportunities is a broader interest in social enterprise. So social enterprise is defined as companies that have as their principal purpose a social purpose. Doesn't mean they can't be for-profit companies, although many times they're not. But increasingly, having this social motivation is driving a significant number of startups. One third of startups, new business startups in the UK today, are socially motivated. The Social Enterprise Club at Harvard Business School, sort of that bastion of capitalism, is now the second largest interest club in the entire school. There's a whole host of new structures being developed. Community interest companies here in the UK, B Corps in the United States, that embrace this idea that a company can be about more than just maximizing its profit. And we should allow for structures that encompass both social motivations and financial motivations. And like all these, like normal commercial enterprises, if you're going to grow a social enterprise, you need capital. And so there are an increasing number of opportunities to provide capital to these companies. And so all of these things are helping to spur the interest in social investing. And again, according to JP Morgan, governments across the UK, the US, the EU and Australia over the last 3 years have made $5 billion available to promote social investment. Over half of that was in the last 12 months alone. A whole host of international financial institutions like JP Morgan, Credit Suisse, UBS, Deutsche Bank are endorsing social investment as a new and distinct asset class. Social impact bonds, which I mentioned here, originated in the UK through this experiment in Peterborough, have been picked up as an idea in the US and in Canada and Australia as an idea and a way of allowing private investors to actually make an investment in social interventions. The EU has launched a social business initiative with 1,000 people and President Barroso and a big budget and a lot of political support in Brussels to try and support social businesses in the EU. And a poll, an Ipsos Mori poll on behalf of Nesta here in the UK, when asked specifically what they described as mass affluent clients, that is clients with investable assets of more than £100,000, asked them, would you, if given the opportunity, would you choose to make, with at least some part of your portfolio, an investment that had both social motivation as well as financial motivation? 65% of the people answered that they would. So there is a significant and growing interest and support for this whole idea. So I guess the big question is, well, if all this is happening, why is more money not flowing? And if I asked everybody in this room to say, look, would you ever, and I guess because you're here, it's a somewhat biased audience, so I won't ask the question because it's probably not a random sample. But if I asked most audiences whether or not they would, the same question Ipsos Mori asked, would you, if you were given the opportunity, would you consider taking some part, 5% or 10% of your portfolio and investing it in investments that you thought would repay your capital, provide you some level of financial return, maybe not what you would consider a commercial risk-adjusted return, would you consider looking at those? And the answer, I think, the majority of the people in this room, I suspect, would say yes. If I asked you then to say, well, actually, how many of you have actually done it? The answer would be almost nobody. If I asked you why you'd never done it, I think the answer would be because you just never see these type of things. You don't know what they look like. You don't know who markets them. Nobody, your people who traditionally advise you on your financial affairs don't typically talk to you about them. So it's really no investment product. So this sort of brings us neatly to the creation of big society capital. Because the government asked how it can be that if we think this appetite exists, and we think the demand for funding certainly exists, how can it be that nothing has happened? And their diagnosis, rightly or wrongly, was that there was no intermediaries in the market. So if, you know, they looked at the commercial markets, and what they see is in this $80 trillion commercial market, tens of thousands of banks and brokers and stock exchanges and venture capital firms all really doing one thing, intermediating the supply and demand of investments and funding. And they saw, obviously, that this intermediary layer had taken centuries to develop but was crucial to the effective functioning of the market. And they looked at the social investment market, and they didn't see any intermediaries, or the ones they saw were tiny and embryonic and small. So they decided that the solution to that problem was to create this organization, which is commonly known, or has been commonly known, as the Big Society Bank, and is now formerly known as Big Society Capital. And that's the organization that I have the pleasure and privilege of being the chief executive of. And our mandate is to grow the social investment market. And we're going to do that in two ways. We're going to do that by investing in these intermediaries, so these people that will help facilitate this flow of funds. And we're going to also act as a champion for the social investment market. And we have two important sources of funding available to us. All the dormant accounts, unclaimed bank accounts that sit around, that have been sitting around in UK banks and building societies for 15 years or more, are being transferred to something called the Reclaims Fund, which will then in turn transfer the money to Big Society Capital. And that is in the region of £400 million. In addition to that, as part of what was called the Merlin Agreement, which is the agreement the government made with the four major UK banks, they agreed to invest a further £200 million in Big Society Capital. So we have £600 million, which is a significant amount by any standards, but it's a significant amount, particularly relative to this sector, to use to invest in the sector, to invest in funds, to invest in management companies, to invest in social banks. We will be independent of government. So once the spending directive is issued, there'll be no government involvement in what we do. There'll be no government representative on the board. We'll be financially transparent. We'll be expected to be self-sufficient. So we won't be handing out any grants. We won't, because we're dealing with intermediaries and our wholesaler, we won't even have any direct relationship with frontline social organizations. We'll be expected to be self-sufficient, which means we're not expected to lose that capital. We're expected to invest it and get it back, and hopefully earn some sort of a small, although certainly by the standards of traditional financial organizations, not a commercial, but still a small return on it. And at the highest level, our success will be judged when, if we're here in 5 years from now, and I ask the question, can you, do you understand what social investment is? You'll say yes. And when I ask you, do you see product? Are you actually making these investments? And are you participating in that market? You will say yes. We'll do our investments will constitute a broad range of, we'll support social investment funds, which already exist in this country through people like Bridges and Big Issue Invest, social banks that again already exist in this country but are small and undercapitalized, the social impact bond structures that I talked about. So there's a whole range of different potential investment opportunities. And we will be an institution which I think, as the government, when they launch us, will proudly state, will be the world's first real social investment bank. So it is I think, an important and really innovative approach to addressing this market. So I don't know, to come back to the original question of that we asked, whether or not this form of social impact investing is a revolution, and whether all the different things that we're doing facilitate a revolution, or whether it just ends up being a small complement to existing philanthropy or government. I think it's way too early to tell. This is a very new and embryonic market. It is, and in order to be long-term and sustainable and growing, there's a whole host of different plumbing that we have to do. We have to start from today. As I said, we're very binary in the way we think about business and investment. We're binary in the sense that we only have two forms. We have two legal forms. You're either charity or you're a for-profit company. Or until very recently, that was true. We have government commissioning that recognizes only public procurement and private or private procurement, so public procurement with all the inefficiencies and lack of innovation that creates, and private procurement with all its supposedly uncaring and profit-driven motives. And then we have investors who see only two choices: make an investment to try and maximize my risk-adjusted return, or give the money away in a philanthropic donation. We have financial regulators who don't recognize social impact investing. So the idea that what constitutes a suitable investment for retail investors, it's not defined by our regulators. We see accountants that put no value on social value, so it becomes very difficult to actually value those assets if you own them. So there's a whole lot of different things that have to happen in terms of plumbing that we have to build, and BSC, Big Society Capital, will have an important role in that, in all of that. So finally, I wanted to talk very briefly about, try to put the momentum behind this type of investing in the context of what's going on in the world, and particularly the important debate that's around the future of capitalism and the need for a more responsible form of capitalism. Because I do think when you look back, when historians in 50 years look back on the post-credit crisis decade, they are going to see it as a period of real change and transformation in our system. And I think the good news for those of us who've been involved in it for a long time is that despite all the problems that we've had over the last 4 or 5 years, particularly in the developed countries, there's really no obvious rejection of market economics. So, no desire to really return to state control of enterprise and the role of the market as an organism that sort of sets prices and allocates resources and rewards risk-taking, innovation, and all those drives innovation. All that, I think, is still widely accepted. And, of course, that's all being buttressed by the fact that we have 2 billion people in emerging markets in India and China and Brazil that have been lifted out of poverty over the last 10 or 15 years, mainly due to their embracing market economics. But I think if we are going to avoid a drift towards a more interventionist form of state capitalism, we are going to have to address some of the problems and some of the weaknesses that have been manifested by the credit crisis and the aftermath of the credit crisis. And one of those things is a failure of regulation and governance. So the idea that, we had the idea that our markets would perfectly allocate resources. And what actually happened was we ended up with individuals and banks and governments embarking in sort of an orgy of leverage, and eventually and inevitably that all came crashing down. And when it came crashing down, the public looked at it and said, you know, it was the same people that led these financial institutions that had enriched themselves to a point that was, you know, to a degree that was sort of unprecedented in the before in the annals of capitalism, and also the fact that we had all these foot soldiers who were also in the financial markets that were doing things that I think the public really didn't recognize as having enormous social value. Governance broke down, boards were ineffective, shareholder representation was ineffective. So all those sort of things, which basically are around governance and regulation, I actually believe, and I know some of my colleagues disagree with me, I actually believe that those things are being taken care of. And I, not perhaps entirely, but to a large extent. And I may be somewhat over-optimistic, but I think better regulated banks, more capital, more attention to how risks are managed, getting rid of some of the perverse incentives that existed to take risks. I think actually more accountable boards, I think all these things which are sort of work in process, I suspect will address many of these problems. And I would be surprised if in the next 30 or 40 or 50 years or in my lifetime we saw another financial crisis of the type that we've seen in the last 4 or 5 years. So that problem of governance and regulation, I think, is being addressed. The second weakness of capitalism is, I think, much more fundamental and much more difficult to address. And that is that there is now overwhelming evidence that capitalism creates increasing levels of inequality. And it creates social consequences for which it has really no correcting mechanism. And if you look at growth in incomes between 1947 and 1979 in the U.S., top quintile and bottom quintile of the population both grew about 100%. So very similar growth in income. Between 1980 and 2010, the top quintile grew, which is actually my history in the financial markets, grew 55%, and the bottom quintile declined by 4%. In the U.S. today, 1% of the population takes 25% of annual income. That's twice what it took 30 years ago. And the top 500 individuals in the U.S. apparently own more of the nation's wealth than the bottom 150 million people. So these are all indications that inequality is increasing. And I guess, speaking personally, I went through the first 25 years of my career in banking thinking, well, that wasn't really such a big problem. I had this sort of belief that rising tides lift all boats, and as long as the average GDP was rising, then everything would be fine. The problem with that is if that rising inequality also leads to a decline in social mobility, that's when you have a problem. And I think, again, speaking personally, I haven't had the pleasure of touring around the country with the Minister for Civil Society, whose name is Nick Hurd, and he and I go and give these speeches in places that I've never been to before, Sheffield and Darlington and Wolverhampton, places that traditionally bankers, Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan, actually don't end up, for obvious reasons. When we go there, we give these speeches, but we also go and talk, you know, go around the daycare center and so on. And I tell you, and I'm somebody, I have 5 children, 3 kids who are in sort of 8, 7, and 6, and I know the education that they get, and I see the education. These are the lucky kids, the ones in the daycare center. And there is no way that those children have any possibility of catching, even at that age, that they have any possibility of making up that gap. And so if you start at the bottom in this country today, the unfortunate truth is you're likely to stay at the bottom. And the theory that the theory that we could all rely on government to provide, you know, the social safety net and encourage mobility, I think has been shown to be false. And that's a big problem. And it will have big, in the same ways that we found the corrective mechanism in the financial markets was that we had a crash that led to enormous economic pain. I think unless we address some of these social consequences, we'll have a similar, we're looking at a period of significant social pain. So what's to be done? And the truth is that investment is the lifeblood of capitalism. It is, in a market economy, it's the people who invest and control the investment flows who decide who grows and who shrinks, who has a job or who gets made redundant, what gets built and what gets knocked down. And for the last 30 years or more, the investment mandate has been all around maximizing short-term profits. And so I do think we have to look at how we can incentivize and ways that we can move away from this sort of short-term self-interested philosophy towards one that's based more on a more long-term holistic view that ensures we get the benefits of the creative destruction that capitalism has driven capitalism, but also puts some value on social outputs and sustainability and some value on the business role in the community. And I think that's what social investment at heart is really about. It's not going to address all those problems, but it's a beginning of, it's one of the things that we think can make a difference. So I think the world of investment is changing. I think the world of companies and the role of companies is changing, whether that's through corporate social responsibility or socially responsible investing or social investing. None of these things existed 10 years ago. I can tell you that high on the agenda, on every politician's agenda, and high on the agenda of chief executives and CIOs and investors around the world, and I think that's going to increase over in coming years. And so I don't know whether, in the end, we'll be sitting here in 5 years or 10 years saying that that social impact investing was a revolution or not. But I do think it will grow in momentum. It will be important, and from my personal position, I feel very privileged and lucky to be part of this. And I hope that I'm grateful for all of you coming tonight to hopefully learn a little bit more about what we mean when we say social investment, and hopefully get the chance at some point in time to participate in it too. Thank you.
You've been listening to an audio recording by the Economic Research Council. For more information, visit www.ercouncil.org.